Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, August 8th, 2003. Today's session is entitled Ebenezer Scrooge, the classic Converted Deadly Sinner, based on Romans chapter 12, verses 1 through 5, session 5 of the Seven Deadly Sins, week 2 of a Bible study presented by Brad Benow, number BIB 2003-10. Let's listen in.
2 weeks, and this is the final session of this Bible study, a series that's focused on the deadly sins. When I teach this course at the seminary, I usually do this day a little differently. We usually find a way to watch some version of Dickens' Christmas Carol, but with only an hour to work with, that wasn't prudent for today, and I couldn't find a copy of it up here anyway, so we're going to be reading portions, but also talking more about it. I've put a list of the deadly sins up here in case you haven't been here for some of them. There you have them all: pride, anger, envy, sloth, greed, gluttony, and lust. And I will endeavor to say something about each one of those in conjunction with Ebenezer Scrooge in the Christmas Carol. But before we go any further with that, let us pray, and to do that, I want to use some words from a Christmas hymn by Phillips Brooks. Let us pray. O Holy Child of Bethlehem, descend to us, we pray. Cast out our sin and enter in, be born in us today. No ear may hear his coming, but in this world of sin, where meek souls will receive him, still the dear Christ enters in. There was once upon a time at Holden Village something of a tradition that had grown up to celebrate a kind of Christmas in July. I've noticed that's been phased out, I think happily so. It was impossible for people not to let that get away from them, and it turned into something much more than what it needed to be. But perhaps today is just a little faint whiff of remembrance of times gone by when something of late December found its way into the summer months. In some way, I think it's useful to think about these things out of season, when we're not distracted by so many other things. Perhaps we can see the theology and the meaning of it all just a little bit more clearly. And it's great fun anyway, and I can't stop myself from engaging in all of that. As we've done the biblical text in conjunction with these themes, we've kind of moved those around in the sessions. But today I want to move this right up front and take a look at part of chapter 12 of Paul's letter to the Romans to set us in motion, because he's talking about transformation. And that, I think, is the central theme of what Dickens is trying to get us to understand out of the Christmas Carol. So if we can read together Romans chapter 12, the first five verses. Anybody have your finger on that as I'm trying to get myself there? Would you like to read that for us, please? What translation do you have there, by the way?
The cover is
the gold translation.
It's authorized King James.
I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. And be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is good and acceptable and perfect, the perfect will of God. For I say, through the grace given unto me, to every man that is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly, according as God hath dealt to every one the measure of faith. For as we have many members in one body, and all members have not the same office, so we, being many, are one body in Christ, and every one members one of another.
Thank you. I'm glad you read that in the King James, because there's one particular word in this passage that, at least in the new RSV, maybe doesn't come through with the clarity that it deserves. It's actually, every once in a while, you get the King James giving you something a little more clearly than more modern translations. And here's one example. The word in verse 1, that's translated in the RSV, the New RSV, as your spiritual worship. And I think in the King James there, it was your reasonable service, right? Mm-hmm. Actually, I'll get to more to this in a minute, but the actual technical, sort of literal background of that word is logical. But to that in just a second. I want to say, first of all, I think that what Paul is doing here overall is urging Christians to be shaped more by the power of God's grace than by the powers and structures of the world. That's the contrast. And so, he says, present your bodies as living sacrifices, which I think means give yourself wholly and totally over to the gracious ways of God. Don't hold anything back. And don't certainly surrender yourself as a living sacrifice to the ways and patterns of the world. And then goes on to say, which is your, whatever you want to call that, spiritual worship, reasonable service, or, as I said, a little bit more literally, your logical worship or service. And I think what Paul is saying here is that the logic of all this is that in the end, when all of the eternal realities of life have to be faced, grace is the only thing that is truly, quote, logical, that really finally makes any kind of sense, that is reasonable, as unreasonable as grace may be. When you get right down to it, it's the only last, final, reasonable, logical reality, as Scrooge finally discovers when all is said and done, as we'll see today. And so Paul is urging Christians, I think, here to align their Christian belief with their Christian living. Let your living give evidence of the things that you believe. Don't walk around espousing one set of principles and doctrines and beliefs and so forth, and then don't have it manifest in how you behave. As if to say, as some theologians have said, words are visible. There are visible words. They come to life in what we do. And as our minds are renewed, our actions are transformed, and then, Paul seems to say, the will of God will be properly discerned or proved or tested, there are various ways to translate that, in our actions. That's the call, I think, is to be both transformed by grace and then discerning in how we live our lives. And certainly, I think we'll see in the transformation of Scrooge, Dickens shows us, I think just wonderfully, beautifully, how these logically transformed actions of Scrooge follow from a renewed and transformed mind. The spirits in their visitation work on his mind, work on his soul, his spirit, his heart. His internal process, and then what we see at the end is a transformed life. That's the springboard from Paul here. Any thoughts does that raise for you as we get ready to jump into the story here? If you have another biblical text in mind that you think might link all this together better, I'm all ears for that. I've just done my own opinion. Let's take a look at the story. Two things I want to do. First, to suggest what I think are some general theological themes in this story, and then to look more specifically at the seven deadly sins themselves as evidenced in the life of Scrooge. I don't in any sense pretend to have captured all the theological themes here, just the ones that strike me and I find interesting and so forth, and so please climb in if you see other things that I'm missing. Dickens was no Lutheran, we know that, but nonetheless, I think a pretty decent theologian and could not therefore escape, even accidentally or something, introducing some Lutheran principles. And maybe I should say before we get into this, you may or may not know that we owe, depending on how you want to look at this, we owe Dickens either the blame or the credit for what we pretty much know as Christmas in our Western culture today. Almost single-handedly through the writing of this story, Dickens salvaged Christmas and turned it into something that had, again, renewed religious significance for people. Christmas was not much observed and practiced in the England of Dickens' day, and how he described some of Scrooge's attitude about Christmas was becoming a more popular way of looking at it. It was not a big festive holiday and so forth. And although we have certainly sentimentalized and whatnot and done some things that maybe theologically aren't so grand because of this story, we've done that with Christmas. I think we have to recognize that Dickens worked a cultural transformation through the story. And he was a person of faith and a religious person, and he had definite religious intent in putting this story out there. As I say, we've used it as we will, depending on how you feel about it. But we have to recognize his cultural contribution at that point. Well, let me suggest a Lutheran theme here, which is I think there's an interesting sort of law-gospel tension and dialectic in this story, and it's built right into the name Ebenezer Scrooge. Now, the name Ebenezer, as you may know, is a biblical name, which reflects the theme of hope. It comes from 2 Samuel or 1 Samuel chapter 7, where there is a stone called an Ebenezer. You may know that hymn, "Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing." Here I raise my Ebenezer. Right? You always wonder. Right. Not lifting up Scrooge. Although I'm sure many of the school childs thought that when they sang that hymn. But Samuel erects this stone after a victory over the Philistines. It's a sign of hope that they raise their Ebenezer. It's a stone of remembrance of the help that God has given and hope that God will always be present. Well, you have the hopeful Ebenezer bumping right up against this harsh name of Scrooge, which I think is simply Dickens' invention. I don't know where that name might come from, although, as somebody has pointed out, can you think of any words in the English language that start with the letters SC that don't have a negative ring to them? Scum.
No,
school has a negative ring. Somehow linguistically, the sk sound is not a pleasant one for the most part on English-speaking ears, and so Dickens has invented this name of Scrooge, which has a harsh, it's the law element here, it seems to me. And in an interesting Lutheran kind of way, they demonstrate that one can be simultaneously justified and sinful, it seems to me, when all is said and done. Scrooge's name does not change, as is often the case with biblical characters, where they get a changed name, but rather renamed. The Scrooge that people despised in the beginning of the story is now a Scrooge that people happily greet on the street by the end of the story. Somehow they bump up against each other. There's also this notion, we'll get to that later when we talk about the visitation of the spirits. Let's see. Let me go back to one or two other things here. This is also, interestingly, an apocalyptic story. I think written self-consciously by Dickens in that kind of a genre. Apocalyptic as a literary piece means that we have usually a person who journeys somewhere far from their origin, often journeying through time, to come back and retell the story for a present audience. This is the basic genre of the Book of Revelation. John is from Patmos is transported to a different time and place, given a vision of the future of heaven, and is told to come back and report that to his contemporary. Rather like that, in the same genre, Scrooge is transported mysteriously through time, past, present, future, and feels this calling to come back and relate the what has happened to him through a changed way of living. So in that sense, we've got a story here that's heavy with biblical theological overtones. And in that strain of apocalyptic and out of the book of Revelation, and as we're thinking about the healing of the world and so forth, I find interestingly Dickens, maybe not even consciously, gives us a vision of the sort of fallen world on the one hand and the New Jerusalem on the other, from the beginning to the end of this story, in how he describes the London in which Scrooge lives. Let me just give you a quick sense of that. At the very beginning of the story, as he's setting the scene for us, we first see London as a very cold, dismal place. Oh, here it is, sorry. Once upon a time, of all the good days in the year, on Christmas Eve, Scrooge sat busy in his counting house. And here you have it. It was a cold, bleak, biting weather, foggy withal, and he could hear the people in the court outside go wheezing up and down, beating their hands upon their breasts, stamping their feet upon the pavement stones to warm them. The city clocks had only just gone three, but it was quite dark already. It had not been light all day, and candles were flaring in the windows of the neighboring offices like ruddy smears upon palpable brown air. Is this dark or what? The fog came pouring in at every chink and keyhole and was so dense without that although the court was of the narrowest, the houses opposite were mere phantoms. To see the dingy cloud come drooping down, obscuring everything, one might have thought that nature lived hard by and was brewing on a large scale. However, by the time we get to Christmas morning at the end, after Scrooge's visitation, when Scrooge discovers that it's Christmas morning, running to the window, he opened it and put out his head. No fog, no mist, clear, bright, jovial, stirring cold, cold, piping for the blood to dance to, golden sunlight, heavenly sky. I mean, are those not New Jerusalem images? Sweet, fresh air, merry bells, oh, glorious, glorious. It's as if the whole thing has been transformed by what has happened. But most interesting to me, I think, in terms of theological themes here, is the, I think what, for the preachers in the audience, you can get some Easter mileage out of this. At least I did one Easter. The whole story is set in motion, you may recall, at the very beginning, page one, when the narrator, or Dickens, says, Marley was dead to begin with. There is no doubt whatever about that. This must be distinctly understood, or nothing wonderful can come of the story I'm going to write. We're led to understand right off the bat that the conversion of Ebenezer Scrooge happens only because he is confronted by a definitive and authoritative word from beyond the grave. And Dickens goes to some pains in the first two, three pages to point this out. You must understand that Marley was absolutely dead. Because if Marley is not dead, then Scrooge's vision is merely self-generated. As he says, you're just a bit of undigested beef, you know, upset stomach, and you're not to be taken seriously. But because Marley is dead and is coming back from the dead, then we're to understand that this is a definitive judgment pronounced upon the sin of Scrooge and Marley's greed. If it's not Marley coming back from the dead with that kind of post-life judgment, then there's always the chance that maybe, you know, you can wring some meaning out of life in ways other than kindness and charity. But finally, that option isn't left open because of the fact that Marley speaks from beyond the grave. Marley's appearance in Scrooge's bedchamber is somehow faintly reminiscent of Jesus' appearance in the upper room. It just he's manifest, and there he is, and don't quite know what to do with him. And, you know, are you real or not? Scrooge asks, "Can you sit down?" Marley says that he can. We're forced to admit here that Marley, more than Scrooge, sees the big picture. Marley's got it straight. The one who's been through death really knows what life is all about. And something wonderful is possible in Dickens' story because this gets clarified right at the beginning, that this is going to be a story about ultimate eternal things and things that truly matter because they shape your eternal destiny. And the one who speaks with authority is the one who's already lived through all that. Well, I think you could say much the same thing to start an Easter sermon. Jesus was dead. And this must be distinctly understood, or nothing wonderful can come of this whole Christian story which we're trying to relate. If Jesus isn't really dead, he can't really come back to life. If Jesus isn't really dead, there's no sort of final definitive judgment on one who's passed all the way through life and experienced it all. I don't know if this is a conscious move on Dickens' part, but it seems to me that's right there. One last thing. There is an interesting Pauline theme, I think, in this whole story about the wages of sin. Marley, in the early visitation, helps us see that the wages of sin are not so much punishment as the fact that one is forced to taste the fruit of one's sin. Famous passage that's in every film version of this, by the way. Marley says, "It is required of every man," the ghost returned, "that the spirit within him should walk abroad among his fellow men and travel far and wide. And if that spirit goes not forth, it is condemned to do so after death. It is doomed to wander through the world. Oh, woe is me, and witness what it cannot share, but might have shared on earth and turned to happiness." And then later in the story, Scrooge witnesses his nephew Fred, you know, having Christmas dinner with his family and so forth. And in spite of it all, Fred will not say anything ill about Scrooge. And when his wife and others sort of prod him to try to do that, Scrooge's nephew Fred says, "Oh, he's a comical old fellow," referring to Scrooge, said Scrooge's nephew, "that's the truth, and not so pleasant as he might be. However, his offenses carry their own punishment, and I have nothing to say against him." That seems to me a truth about sin that Dickens wants us to understand here, that you just reap the fruit of your own sinning. And it isn't even necessary to have punishment visited upon you. The misery that all that brings is punishment enough in and of itself, and then we see that in Marley's being chained and fettered and so forth. Okay. Well, those are a few theological themes. Let me see. Do you resonate with those, or can you think of others that you might want to add before we get into deadly sins here?
I just want to say it's almost comforting that quote you gave, that offenses carry their own punishment. So many times you think, well, how could God visit this punishment upon us? You know, but
it is a God.
Yeah.
We did it to ourselves.
Right. Yeah, one of... Save that for later. Anybody else? All right. Well, let's take a look, and I've got more to read, so I'll try to illustrate what I'm talking about here as we go along. Let me say, first of all, some of these are a little more of a stretch than others, okay? Dickens obviously wasn't sitting there with Gregory the Great in front of him trying to write out the seven deadly sins or anything. But I think to the extent that you can use a piece of literature to elucidate the deadly sins, that's interesting and helpful. let's just go in order. Pride is the first deadly sin, taken to be the most deadly of all. That's why it was put at the head of the list. We've talked about that as the refusal to take other persons into account, setting yourself up as your own creator, as your own God, a kind of idolatry, the unwillingness to hear or to respect that other people are of equal importance to yourself. You set up your own criteria for evaluation and refuse to sort of look at how God sees that. Well, we meet a Scrooge early on in the story who refuses to be engaged with others, who sets himself apart. And this also, we see this as a constant theme in Scrooge's unredeemed life of the isolation and the aloneness and the stand-apartness that he seems to feel. In the opening of the story, on Christmas Eve, two men come to Scrooge's office, to his counting house, asking him to make a charitable contribution. And here's how that part of the story goes. He's talking to these two. Well, they first of all, they see the name on the sign, Scrooge and Marley, and they don't know that Marley is dead, because Scrooge, in his sloth, has never gotten around to taking Marley's name on the sign. But there are other reasons for that, too, as we'll see. Scrooge and Marley are almost a merged identity. And so it's not accidental that he hasn't done that. But these two people who come, they, have I the pleasure of addressing Mr. Scrooge or Mr. Marley? And he has to clarify that Marley has been dead. Let's see. So one of them says, at this festive season of the year, Mr. Scrooge, said the gentleman, taking up a pen, it is more than usually desirable that we should make some slight provision for the poor and destitute who suffer greatly at the present time. Many thousands are in want of common necessaries. Hundreds of thousands are in want of common comfort, sir. Are there no prisons? Asked Scrooge. Oh, plenty of prisons, said the gentleman, laying down his pen. And the union workhouses, demanded Scrooge. Are they still in operation? Well, they are still, returned the gentleman. I wish I could say they were not. The treadmill and the poor law are in full vigor then, said Scrooge. Oh, both very busy, sir. Oh, I was afraid from what you said at first that something had occurred to stop them in their useful course, said Scrooge. I'm very glad to hear that. Under the impression they scarcely furnish Christian cheer of mind or body to the multitude, returned the gentleman, a few of us are endeavoring to raise a fund to buy the poor some meat and drink and means of warmth. We choose this time because it is a time of all others when want is keenly felt and abundance rejoices. What shall I put you down for? Nothing, Scrooge replied. You wish to remain anonymous. I wish to be left alone, said Scrooge. Since you asked me what I wish, gentlemen, that is my answer. I don't make merry myself at Christmas, and I can't afford to make idle people merry. I help to support the establishments I have mentioned. They cost enough, and those who are badly off must go there. Many can't go there, and many would rather die. If they would rather die, said Scrooge, they had better do it and decrease the surplus population. Besides, excuse me, I don't know that. But you might know it, observed the gentleman. It's not my business, Scrooge returned. It's enough for a man to understand his own business and not to interfere with other people's. Mine occupies me constantly. Good afternoon, gentlemen. We'll see later in the story how those exact words are brought back to him by one of the spirits. And in fact, it visited on him that perhaps it would be good for him to die and decrease the surplus of poverty. that he has no real right to live in a world with people as tender as Tiny Tim. Well, that's just one possible slice of pride. How does that strike you? Do you see other evidences of pride in Scrooge, or other characters for that matter?
I don't really see that as being pride at all. I've never read the book. I've seen the original. The good one with Alistair Sim. To me, what motivates the guy more than anything else is fear. Hmm. When you go back to you know, when he's confronted with the possibility of the of moving on from who's he working for? Fezziwig.
Yeah, right.
Fezziwig. You know, and right. And the guy offers him a gig with this other with the vested interests.
Yeah.
It seems like his he gives a little speech there where he talks about, you know, not wanting to get trampled under. And everything else, you know, by what's happening economically in Britain at that
yeah.
time. And it seems like everything else that he does is based upon that one thing, his fear of being trampled under by circumstances around him. And he builds these walls to and everything else is a consequence of that.
And I want to get to that a little more, I think, when we get to anger. But I would say, you know, maybe the two aren't all that unconnected, that our prideful disposition often does come out of fear. We talked, I think, I tried to link these deadly sins to the various stages of the life cycle and suggest there's a certain time when these dispositions come about. And I believe we were talking about pride in conjunction with the industry inferiority connection somewhere in the school age, and that it's possible to want to take more credit for what you can industriously do than is appropriate, out of a sense of fear of inferiority that maybe you're not good enough. So as in most all cases here, these things overlap and you can't maybe slice them out totally cleanly. But I think what I'm trying to point to here with pride is the way that Scrooge's arrogance and so forth isolates him and cuts him off from the concerns of humankind. And as Marley will say to him, you know, this was my business, to be involved in, you know, mankind was my business, says Marley. So, I mean, point well taken, and whatever. Yeah.
I guess I've always thought...
I can't say whatever.
you're looking for talking about Scrooge as a person. I think a lot of the book here is a societal... pictorial
right.
of England at the time of
right.
the industrial time here,
yep.
and the great disparity between haves and have-nots, and Scrooge's attitude at that time, you're putting him on as a person, was an attitude shared by a hierarchy within England,
right.
Of which the author was trying to epitomize and show in a very, you know, blatant light.
Yep.
So you're talking a person, but it's a societal picture of England. When you talk about the dark clouds, that's because
yep.
it's the
yep.
Cold
yep.
Revolution
yep.
and the value of life.
Right.
So I mean, I'm just trying to stretch.
No, I think that's right. I think this is, as I tried to say here, these are, Scrooge is the personification of these deadly sins, but they do play out on a broader scale, and I think it's amazing how in the 21st century we still deal with the haves and the have-nots, the lack of charity, the lack of global vision, that there's still a resonance with these basic themes. They haven't gone away. And that those things are with us still.
Yeah.
Well, I think the thing that he said, he seems oblivious to any societal factors that might have contributed to his success.
Mm-hmm.
That he's successful simply because he takes care of his own business, and there's no, and that's
right.
that's easy to do. What particularly when you've been raised comfortably.
Yeah.
You think that somehow you had something to do with that, and you're entitled. And that's prideful.
As somebody said of George Bush, born on third base and thought he hit a triple. Politics aside, you can say that about any other Democrats too, but that's the attitude, you know, of entitlement that, you know, right. Back here.
Back to Marley and Scrooge. This is a storyline in some great literature. For instance, some years ago, my family, some of us, anyone, I went to the Metropolitan Opera, got our seats in the balcony, and the opera Don Giovanni began.
Right.
And Don Giovanni comes out as an impressive Lothario, and the list of his women that he seduced, you know, runs into the hundreds. And this is a shameful life. Father dies, and on the stage at the Metropolitan Opera, a huge specter.
Right.
Somehow they got it out there, illuminated everything. frightening, awesome thing. Scared the wits out of Don Giovanni, and I think it changed his life.
Right.
But Don Giovanni, I think, is a great opera, not only because of the music, which is fantastic, but that element of transformation, just like with Scrooge, it's a powerful message. If you get into Les Miserables, what's the story there? Again, the transformation of a person. I forget exactly why he does in Les Miserables, but on the stage play, you know, the guy is entirely different afterwards from before.
Yeah, it's, I mean, when you find a theme that's that common, I say, hey, you must have something good theologically going on. Well, let me move on to envy here, if I can, just throw out a thought on that. I want to say, in the George C. Scott film version of A Christmas Carol, I believe, there's a reference made to the fact that Scrooge's mother died giving birth to Scrooge. But it's not in the book, I don't think. I haven't been able to discover it. And I don't know where that came from. It's too bad it's not in the book, because it's an interesting theme. Because in a sense, we see then Scrooge's father carrying this grudge towards Scrooge. We get this sense of, you know, his father has sent him to boarding school. He visits that with the Ghost of Christmas Past. And there's a kind of envy coming out of his father, if indeed it was that his mother died. It's like he blames Scrooge for the death of the spouse or something. But I don't know, we can't go too far with that, because that's in the film version and Dickens didn't write it. Let me suggest one thing that is more authentic to Dickens, though, that Scrooge's general treatment of Cratchit, Bob Cratchit and the Cratchit family, and the way he treats a boy who comes wanting to sing him a Christmas carol on Christmas Eve, which he'll express regret for later, is sadly informative. Remembering that we define envy as the desire to have everybody else be as unhappy and unsuccessful as you are. Scrooge's intent to drag everybody down to his level of misery where Christmas is concerned. And so Dickens describes this boy coming to sing the Christmas carol. He says, "The owner of one scant young nose, gnawed and mumbled by the hungry cold as bones are gnawed by dogs, scooped down at Scrooge's keyhole to regale him with a Christmas carol. But at the first sound of God bless you, merry gentlemen, may nothing you dismay, Scrooge seized the ruler with such energy of action that the singer fled in terror, leaving the keyhole to the fog and even more congenial frost." And then it goes on immediately with Scrooge's confrontation of Cratchit. You know, "You'll want all day tomorrow, I suppose," says Scrooge. "Oh, if it's quite convenient, sir." "Well, it's not convenient," said Scrooge, "and not fair. If I was to stop half a crown for it, you'd think yourself ill-used, I think." Clerk smiled faintly. "And yet," said Scrooge, "you don't think me ill-used when I pay a day's wages for no work." The clerk observed that it was only once a year. "A poor excuse for picking a man's pocket every 25th of December," said Scrooge, buttoning his greatcoat to the chin. "But I suppose you must have the whole day. Be here all the earlier the next morning." I mean, oh boy. if he's going to be miserable, then everybody's got to be miserable, and that's the deal. But let me move on to anger, because we already touched on this. I tried to say when we talked about anger that anger is a secondary emotion. It's almost never the first thing we feel. It's what we feel in the wake of some episode of having been hurt. And it's because we usually can't get that hurt into focus very well that the anger is what comes forth and is what we see. But what's necessary is try to just lift the lid on that anger and look a little deeper and see, well, what really was the hurt? I think we see a Scrooge in this story who has never really recovered from serious personal hurts in his life, and never has been able or taken the time to try to understand what those mean. There's the meanness of his father that's clearly there. There is the death of his sister. Well, I don't really know about his mother, but his sister, Fan, who they have a tender moment as he visits his past and so forth. She's inviting him home for Christmas, but she does die, giving birth to his nephew Fred. And so one of the people in his young life that he was close to is taken away from him, and, you know, can't deal with that. Marley has died, the one person in his adult life who he felt some closeness to. It seems to me that much of his anger is a reaction to these kind of untended wounds that he has felt. And Fred may be the only person who has adequate sympathy for him along these lines and wants to give him some space. Does that make any sense? Mm-hmm. How that would flow? Well, let's get on here with that. I think the fundamental, maybe fundamental sin here, which is sloth. Reminding ourselves that, as we talked about sloth, this is not simply laziness. Scrooge was not a lazy person. Scrooge was incredibly industrious, couldn't have made all the wealth and so forth. Sloth really is better understood in a contemporary way as apathy, as a lack of caring, a lack of involvement, a lack of passion in the affairs of the world. And so we saw it in that passage I read a moment ago when Scrooge says, you know, if they would rather die, they had better do it and decrease the surplus population. And here he says, again, you know, it's not my business to take care of the affairs of other people. And then, that's what he says in the counting house when the gentlemen come to visit him. But later that evening, when Marley makes his visitation, Marley brings these words back to him in a somewhat different way. Marley says, "Oh, captive bound and double ironed," cried the phantom, "not to know that ages of incessant labor by immortal creatures for this earth must pass into eternity before the good of which it is susceptible is all developed. Not to know that any Christian spirit working kindly in its little sphere, whatever it may be, will find its mortal life too short for its vast means of usefulness. Not to know that no space of regret can make amends for one life's opportunity misused. Yet such was I, oh, such was I." And Scrooge responds, "But you were always a good man of business, Jacob." And Scrooge, who now began to apply this to himself. "Business," cried the ghost, wringing its hands again. "Mankind was my business. The common welfare was my business. Charity, mercy, forbearance, and benevolence were all my business. The dealings of my trade were but a drop of water in the comprehensive ocean of my business." That, it seems to me, is the one thing Scrooge does not get, and from which he most needs to be redeemed and experience conversion. That all that we do impacts the world, that we are not solitary, and that as the end of the passage from Romans says, we who are many are one body in Christ, and individually we are members one of another. Scrooge doesn't get it. And that's maybe where he most needs to take hold. I don't know. That for me is one of the most moving parts of the whole story, because again, it's so contemporary. I mean, it's 60 years now since the writing of this, but there it is. How does it strike you?
Certainly could have and should have been written today.
Grant, I was going to say, the word sloth has almost died.
Yeah. Yep.
Did that say something?
I think we need to just put the theological meaning then into something like apathy or whatever. I mean, language changes and words evolve, and avarice was the previous way to talk about greed, but we've brought greed to the fore, and that still has some teeth in it. Yeah, but I think this is part of our theological calling, is not to lose sight of the concept. If you don't want to call it sloth, that's okay. I mean, whatever. but let's call it apathy or indifference or callous disregard, or as long as we say it's sinful, it's wrong, it's not helpful. This is not the, if you're a justified sinner, justified sinners just don't have the calling to sit on the sideline and not care. I mean, as Paul would say, if your heart and mind have been renewed and transformed, it ought to be lived out in a tangible way. That's the sanctification principle that we've been trying to follow along here. Well, okay, on to greed. This is so obvious, I mean, maybe don't need to say a whole lot about it, but there is an interesting passage where this comes out, and Dickens even names it as greed in a sense, although I want to come back to this when we get to lust here in a moment as well. In his visitation to his past with the first spirit, he has what I find just maybe the most poignant scene in the whole story when he sees this encounter that he had in his previous life with this woman, Belle, to whom he was engaged and would have been married. The spirit of Christmas past says, "My time grows short. Quick." This was not addressed to Scrooge or to anyone to whom he could see, but it produced an immediate effect. For again, Scrooge saw himself. He was older now. This was after he'd seen himself in school and so forth as a child. He was older now, a man in the prime of life. His face had not the hard and rigid lines of later years, but it had begun to wear the signs of care and avarice. There was an eager, greedy, restless motion in the eye, which showed the passion that had taken root and where the shadow of the growing tree would fall. And I'll save the rest of that reading for in a moment, but we go on to see that Belle says to him, "You're not the same person I first fell in love with. Money has become your idol. That's your passion. I don't fit anymore, and so I release you from our promise of marriage." Scrooge has, you know, fairly quickly in his young adult life narrowed things down so that he has virtually no relationship left with the world outside of himself. It's him and the affair that he's having with his money. It's possible to have affairs in life with all kinds of things that don't involve another person. It's wherever your primary emotional commitment goes, that's what you're having an affair with. Another part, though, that I want to stress here about greed, because when we talked about greed, we mentioned this, that greed is not a victimless sin or victimless crime, and that's why classically the virtue of mercy was applied to greed. We've lost a bit of that strain, too. But Dickens shows us so clearly how the Cratchit family as a whole is victimized by Scrooge's greed. And in fact, there are there's at least one other visitation with the ghost of Christmas present where another family is visited. Or no, this is in the future. Another family is visited, and they're happy that Scrooge has died because they will be released from the debt that he was so onerously pressing down upon them. And so his greed did bring about the misery of so many others. And then, of course, maybe most telling is this scene right at the end of his encounter with the ghost of Christmas present, before it transitions into the final scene with the eerie ghost of the future. When Scrooge encounters these two small children under the robes of the ghost, from the foldings of its robe it brought two children, wretched, abject, frightful, hideous, miserable. They knelt down at its feet and clung upon the outside of its garment. And the ghost says, "Oh man, look here. Look down here." They were a boy and a girl, yellow, meager, ragged, scowling, wolfish, but prostrate too in their humility. For graceful youth should have filled their features out and touched them with its precious tints, a stale and shriveled hand like that of age had pinched and twisted them and pulled them into shreds. Where angels might have sat enthroned, devils lurked and glared out menacing. No change, no degradation, no perversion of humanity in any grade. Through all the mysteries of wonderful creation has monsters half so horrible and dread. Scrooge started back, appalled. Having them shown to him in this way, he tried to say they were fine children, but the words choked themselves, rather than be parties to a lie of such enormous magnitude. "Spirit, are they yours?" Scrooge could say no more. "They are man's," said the spirit, looking down upon them. "And they cling to me, appealing from their fathers. The boy is ignorance, this girl is want. Beware them both, and all of their degree, but most of all beware this boy, for on his brow I see that written which is doom, unless the writing be erased. Deny it, cried the spirit, stretching out its hand toward the city. Slander those who tell it ye, admit it for your facetious purposes, and make it worse, and abide the end. Have they no refuge or resource, cried Scrooge. Are there no prisons, said the spirit, turning on him for the last time with his own words. Are there no workhouses? And the bell struck 12. And in the George C. Scott version of the film, these children are incredibly portrayed as just the most pathetic little creatures. And so, as he says, you know, you should see the angelic countenance of glory in small children, but here these shriveled, I mean, this is a very much a reflection of the societal times and the best of times, worst of times, and so forth, the times that Dickens lived in. But how utterly true today. If you were here on Wednesday when I was telling the story in the sermon about these street children in Estonia that a church has found and taken in, much the same kind of a thing. You know, those who live in abundance and do not share with those who haven't enough, it's about greed, and there is definitely an impact that plays out from that. One last thing. In the Muppet Christmas Carol version of this, with Michael Caine as Scrooge, which is, you know, wildly unfaithful to the story in certain ways, but marvelously faithful to it in other ways. I think Michael Caine is actually a very good Scrooge. How many of you have seen that, by the way? Kermit the Frog as Bob Cratchit, and Gonzo and Rizzo as the narrators of the story. There's a scene in the Counting House where Kermit, as Cratchit, is being, you know, regaled by Scrooge and blamed. But as sort of assistants in the Counting House, Kermit Cratchit has a bunch of little mice who work with him. Somehow it's clearer there that Scrooge's desire to be so greedy and accumulate all this wealth for himself leaves these poor mice just absolutely destitute with nothing. And yet they're groveling, you know, they're trying desperately to please. I mean, it's comical in a sense and it's pathetic in another. They try so desperately to please him, and nothing, of course, can be done. And they live way out at the margins of existence there. Scrooge, in that sense, is the classic miser. And as we said, the root of miser and miserable are the same basic word.
What I was going to say is he was definitely miserable. He didn't turn on the heat. He ate broth for dinner. So it was like he didn't even use what he had to make himself comfortable and happy.
Right. He could have done so much more, but he tasted the fruits of his own sin. Well, and here, you helpfully introduced the next deadly sin of gluttony. One evidence of which is people do not enjoy food in company with others. Scrooge is described to us early in the story as being a very solitary figure. He takes his meal on Christmas Eve alone at a tavern, then he returns to his residence and he eats his meager gruel all by himself in this very dark room with one small lump of coal. I mean, he could have made himself comfortable. He's suffering from a cold in the beginning of the story, yet he sits there, you know, huddled up, just utterly alone and isolated, as it were. In his gluttony, we don't so much get the sense of him as a consumptive eater of massive amounts of food, but rather one of his sins against food is he can't share it, he can't enjoy it. Of course, until he does finally on Christmas get to the party with bread and so forth. I mean, talk about the Messianic banquet. That's pretty wonderful stuff. There is a Dickens does have a real ability to talk about the meaning of food, and there's a scene, it's long, I won't read it, but when Scrooge is making the visit with the Ghost of Christmas Present, they walk through the London of Christmas morning with the grocers still open, with bountiful poultry in the shops and chestnuts practically falling out the doors of various stores and so forth. And you get this sense of the great feast that's being prepared by those who know how to enjoy it and can enjoy it. And Scrooge is not quite there yet in terms of his ability to really take that in, although he will eventually get there. Well, the last, I've been struggling with lust, and, you know, is there any lust in this story? And that's the one that seems somewhat problematic. It's not a very racy story or anything. You know, Fred and Heidi's here like we had in that. But there is this point, as somebody pointed out to me yesterday, we recall that lust is the deadly disposition, according to Erikson's schedule of human development, that sets in early adulthood when the crisis issue is intimacy versus isolation. And this really is an issue. And since lust doesn't have to be all about sexuality, it is true that here greed and lust can often go together. And Scrooge certainly does lust after money and possessions. And it's precisely because of that that he is not able to develop in adult life appropriate, intimate connections with others. And certainly that's true with Belle. And so, just to pick up a little bit from where I was reading a minute ago, in his conversation with Belle, he finds himself then, he was not alone, this is in his visitation with the ghost of Christmas past, he was not alone but sat by the side of a fair young girl in a morning dress, in whose eyes there were tears which sparkled in the light that shone out of the ghost of Christmas past. It matters little, she said softly, to you very little, and another idol has displaced me. And if it can cheer and comfort you in time to come, as I would have tried to do, I have no just cause to grieve. What idol has displaced you? Scrooge rejoined. A golden one. And then he says, this is the even-handed dealing of the world. There is nothing on which it is so hard as poverty. There is nothing it professes to condemn with such severity as the pursuit of wealth. You fear the world too much, she answered gently, back to the fear issue. All your other hopes have merged into the hope of being beyond the chance of its sordid reproach. I have seen your nobler aspirations fall off one by one until the master passion gain engrossed you, have I not? What then, he retorted. Even if I have grown so much wiser, what then? I have not changed toward you. She shook her head. Am I? And then she releases him from the contract. That, I think, is a sad, poignant moment in the story when we see it all just getting away from him. Well, let me, if I can have 30 more seconds, touch on one more thing, wrap this up. A final point here theologically, it seems to me, is about sanctification, and that this is more than just a story about justification, although it's certainly about Scrooge's death to himself and his conversion by a power not of his own choosing. It's also a story about what kind of commitments in life are possible given the reality of one's justification. So to end on this note, with the theme for the village here for the summer, for the healing of the world, it seems to me our ongoing conversion from sin to the sanctified life finally and ultimately is about something more than just personal transformation. It's about becoming part of one body, that vision from Paul, everybody with the same function. It's about being participants in the healing of the world. This story, it seems to me, finally, is about Scrooge's discovery of where he fits into everything altogether. And so we'll just end with the wonderful words at the end of the story here. When all is said and done, Scrooge was better than his word. He did it all, and infinitely more, and to Tiny Tim, who did not die, he was a second father. He became as good a friend, as good a master, as good a man, as the good old city knew, or any other good old city, town, or borough in the good old world. Some people laughed to see the alteration in him, but he let them laugh, and little heeded them. For he was wise enough to know that nothing ever happened on this globe for good at which some people did not have their fill of laughter at the outset, and knowing that such as these would be blind anyway, he thought it quite as well that they should wrinkle up their eyes and grins as have the malady in less attractive forms. His own heart laughed, and that was quite enough for him. I read a prayer a few days ago from Ted Loader talking about damned fools and undamned fools. Ted Loader in that prayer says, we are called to join the parade of undamned fools. That's Scrooge. First a damned fool, now an undamned fool who doesn't care if people laugh at him in his generosity. He had no further intercourse with spirits, but lived upon the total abstinence principle. I want somebody to explain that to me, what that means. Ever afterwards. And it was always said of him that he knew how to keep Christmas well if any man alive possessed the knowledge. May that truly be said of all of us and every one of us. And so, as Tiny Tim observed, God bless us, everyone. Well, thank you. And